From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, we meet the creator of the new tango, Argentinian composer Astor Piazzolla. He's updated his country's popular music form, and for that, he's been branded as both an innovator and an assassin. Also today, we talk with jazz singer Helen Merrill. Back in the 50s, she collaborated on an album of songs with composer and arranger Gil Evans. They re-recorded those same songs 30 years later, shortly before Evans' death. Also, jazz critic Evan Whitehead reviews pianist Ken Werner's recording of tunes by Bix Beiderbecke, Duke Ellington, George Gershwin, and James P. Johnson. And television critic David Bianculli has a preview of the new TV series Baby Boom. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Astor Piazzolla is an Argentinian composer who was at the forefront of the tango revival. His music was featured in the Broadway hit Tango Argentina, but he is in no way a revivalist. In fact, he's the father of the new tango. The new tango is a hybrid of traditional tango, classical music, jazz, and rock. When Piazzolla started performing his new tangos in the mid-50s, tango traditionalists in his country acted as if he had committed treason. They verbally and physically attacked him. This is an example of the music that provoked such a strong reaction. It's from his album Zero Hour, which introduced him to American audiences. Astor Piazzolla is featured on bandoneon. It's an accordion-like instrument, but instead of a keyboard on one side, there are buttons on both sides. Astor Piazzolla has performed in concert halls around the world, and he's collaborated with writer Jorge Luis Borges, filmmaker Jean Moreau, and jazz musicians Jerry Mulligan and Gary Burton. When Piazzolla was 3 years old, he moved with his parents from Argentina to New York, where he lived until he was a teenager. He returned to Argentina in 1937. He composed for the Buenos Aires Philharmonic Orchestra and performed with tango groups. He told me that it was in 1954 that he first performed his new tangos. I asked him about the state of the traditional tango in Argentina at that time.
It was going out. I mean, there was a very big invasion of Elvis Presley and rock music and boleros from Mexico. Bill Haley was invading also Argentina with his music. And the young Argentinians, 15, 16, the teenagers of my country, started listening to this more exciting music and not that boring tango that they have been playing during 50 or 60 years in Argentina. So the young people wanted more electricity in their veins, and they chose American music, and then after they chose English music, and today that's how the people are divided in my country, with English and American music, and the old people of 50 years up like tango. They still like the old-fashioned tango, but the new tango, the one I play, fortunately, it's the people of rock and roll who love my music, the people who like modern jazz, or the people who like to listen to Bela Bartok or Stravinsky. That's the people who follow my music.
Now, you got the nickname the Assassin of the Tango when you started playing the new tango. Were there actually threats against you by people who were very upset with you for having taken the traditional tango and made something else of it?
Yes, yes. The telephones, menaces, and my family and me, and they used to call me on the phone and say they would wait for me in the streets, and they would give me a beating. Why? Just because I changed the tango. But I didn't change the tango. What I changed is the way of playing and the way of writing. I mean, I gave it a new dimension, harmonically speaking, and with rhythmically speaking, and the way I arranged it. I mean, nobody was interested in changing tango because they didn't have the condition to do it.
So you had people who were literally calling you up and threatening on the telephone, trying to pick fights with you because of your new tango music. Why do you think that your music caused such a violent reaction? I mean, people like music, they dislike music, but they don't necessarily want to try to kill the composer of the music they dislike.
Number one, the people couldn't dance with my music. The dancers of tango hated me. They detested Astor Piazzolla. You can't dance with Astor Piazzolla. The singers of Argentina detested me. They hated my music because it wasn't singing music. Nobody sang my music. So I was playing instrumental music during 5 or 6 years, and really it was a flop. I had to leave Argentina, and it was in 1958 that I had to abandon this idea of being a musician in my own country. I came to another. This was the second time. I was living in 1924 in New York till 1937. Nearly 14 years when I was a boy. Then I came back in 1958, and it's very strange. We went together with Lalo Schifrin. We came to New York, and Lalo Schifrin went to the sky, and I went to hell directly because nobody loved my music, nobody understood my music, and nobody wanted me to record. Even if I made one stupid record, I call it stupid because it was good for nothing. When you do what the other people want, I think it always is stupid.
Well, I want to talk with you more about your music, but let's listen to some of your music first. My guest is Astor Piazzolla, the performer, composer who invented what's now called New Tango. And you have a new record out that features a concerto that you wrote for bandolian, which is your instrument, and the conductor is Lalo Schifrin, who you just mentioned. He's conducting the Orchestra of St. Luke's. I want to play an excerpt of the presto, the last movement of this concerto. Tell us a little bit about it and about writing a concerto for bandolian and orchestra.
Well, there's nothing written. There's no composer in the world that wrote a concerto for bandolian. So in 1979, I was the first one to compose a concerto for bandolian. And then I wrote another concerto, the three tangos, 1 year after. It was such a great success with the people seeing that their instrument, the native instrument of Argentina, the bandolian, who only it's played in tango orchestras, was now performing in concert halls. So that was very important for me.
Okay, let's listen to the presto, the final movement from the Concerto for Bandonian that my guest Astor Piazzolla composed, just recorded with conductor Lalo Schifrin.
Thank you.
It's an excerpt from the final movement of Astor Piazzolla's new Concerto for Bandoneon, which was just released on Nonesuch Records with conductor Lalo Schifrin. My guest is Argentinian tango composer Astor Piazzolla, the father of the new tango. That's really wonderful music. I want to talk about growing up in New York. It's really ironic in a way that the person who furthered the tradition of the Argentinian tango actually spent most of his childhood growing up in New York City. Your parents moved with you when you were three to New York. Why did they want to leave Argentina?
Well, my father, he was a dreamer, like his father. My grandfather was a dreamer. He was a sailor. He sailed from Italy, from the north of Italy, in the Adriatic, the city of Trani. They came to Mar del Plata, where we live 400 kilometers south of Buenos Aires. And that's where all the, nearly all Italian families live in Argentina, in this port of Mar del Plata. So my grandfather was a dreamer and a sailor. My father was a dreamer, and I continue to be a dreamer also. And that's why we came to New York. My father, my mother, and I am the only son in the family. And the three of us came to New York in 1923. And nearly 14 years, I went to school here. I know more the Star Spangled Banner than my my own hymn from Argentina.
But what about tangos? Did you hear many tangos when you were growing up?
Well, I was born playing John Sebastian Bach on the bandoneon because it sounds more like an organ as the instrument. My teacher, I had a very important piano concert player. His name was Bela Wilda. He was Hungarian, and he taught me to play old classical music and the bandoneon. I never played a tango when I was small.
Did you hate tango like a lot of children growing up hate their parents' music?
Well, I hated to do what my father wanted, but my father suddenly started loving John Sebastian Bach, and he was next to me. He was my friend. He was the one who insisted that I should play classical music. He loved more that his son would be a classical musician than a popular tango musician.
Did you start playing tangos at all when you were in New York?
I started in 1934, yes, with Carlos Gardel. He was a very important singer from Argentina. He came to New York to... he made three films in New York and Long Island with John Reinhardt as a director. And I played the music in the tango music in the film and while he was singing. And that's how I started my career as a tango musician.
That was just a couple of years after that you moved back to Argentina, right?
In 37, before the war, my father got scared and we went all back to Argentina. And I started my musical career when I was 18 years old, between 17 and 18 years old in the city of Buenos Aires. I left Mar del Plata. And I started with the best orchestras. That's when I received my first crash as a tango musician. I started all of a sudden to love tango, and all the education, the classical education I had. Imagine, I used to play Rhapsody in Blue of Gershwin on the bandoneon. I used to play Sophisticated Lady of Ellington, and the people used to look at me as if I was a Martian. I mean, you can never find a bandoneon player in Argentina. I don't know if today if someone exists who could play the Rhapsody in Blue or...
You also studied piano, right?
Yes, I studied piano and composition. I studied everything in music. But the most tremendous of all is tango world. I mean, the tango people are people that are born and live and die only for tango. They are not interested in other manifestations of music or painting or theater. And my teacher, my musical teacher in Buenos Aires, who was Alberto Ginastera, he always told me that it's not only music you must learn in this world. You have to know whom are the painters, the poets, all the writers, and you must go to the theater and see plays. And that's how I was... I grew like that.
I want to talk with you more about your life and your music, but first we're going to take a short break. Composer and bandoneon player Astor Piazzolla is my guest, and he's an Argentinian composer, the founder of what's called New Tango. We'll hear more of his music and talk more after this break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio. Thank you.
Argentinian composer Astor Piazzolla is my guest, the founder of the New Tango. So you studied with Ginastera, and you also went to Paris to study with Nadia Boulanger. And many great composers have wonderful stories about how Boulanger changed their lives and changed their music. You have a story like that, too.
When I arrived to Paris in 54 with all my music, I thought I was a genius because I wrote 20 symphonies and 20 sonatas and so many chamber music pieces. And all of a sudden, Nadia Boulanger, in one afternoon in 3 or 4 hours, looks all over my music and says, "This is good for nothing. Throw it away because I can't find Astor Piazzolla." And she wanted to know which is my real profession as a musician. I was very ashamed to tell her that I played in a nightclub. In those moments, I was playing in a cabaret, not a nightclub. It's too refined to say a nightclub. It was a cabaret in Buenos Aires. I played there, and I studied at the same time. And she says, "You play tango. Oh, that's beautiful. I love tango." And now she's going to ask me if I play piano or what I play. And I have to tell her I play bandoneon. It's worse. So I told her, "Look, I don't play piano. I'm not a pianist. I'm a very bad pianist. I play bandoneon." "Oh, bandoneon, that's beautiful. I love that instrument. I can hear that in Kurt Weill's music, and I can hear that also in Boris Blacher, and all famous German composers use the bandoneon in symphonic orchestras." So she gave me this strength to believe in myself. She was like my second mother. She spoke to me like my mother never spoke to me. She taught me to believe in myself. And since that moment, I started believing in myself and in tango music also, above all.
So you kind of really needed her permission to write in your own voice.
Yes, I needed her permission. She was the only one. I needed somebody that was superior. And she was really superior to everybody. And she loved my music. She loved my tango music. She heard it, and she said, "This is Astor Piazzolla. Please, don't ever leave it."
You know, tango is, at least to us Americans, associated with whorehouses and clubs and things like that. I don't know so what about clubs, but
you forgot Hernando's Hideaway.
Right, sure. That's right. But did you go through a period like that when you were in Argentina before you started composing the new tangos and giving recitals as opposed to playing for dancers? Well, did you go through a period of playing in whorehouses at all?
Well, yes, I played. I'm a normal man. I mean, I played in whorehouses since I was 18. I played when I was 45. I played, that was the last one, when I, 1963 or 64. But one day, only 2 days. I mean, I wasn't employed as a musician to play in whorehouses or bordels. I just played those 2 days, and it was something I really didn't know, but I had much fun because I was considered as a very exponent of a cultural music in Argentina, and all of a sudden I found myself playing in a whorehouse. So that was very funny for me.
You know, the tango is also a dance associated with this real macho ethic. Is that true? I mean, you've actually played tangos. You're not looking at it at a distance. Is it really associated with a very macho style?
Yes, it's a way of making love. That's I found out of this action when I was only 18 or 19 years old. I was seeing the people dancing when I was playing not with my orchestra, with other orchestras I used to play with. And I used to see how they were so compenetrated of what they were dancing. They danced with their eyes closed as if they were dreaming. And it was the man and the woman at the same time. And at the same time, they made love. And it was so strange. I was so young, and I was looking at this as discovering something I never saw in my life.
Are there is there a mystique about the sexual prowess of tango musicians?
Well, I don't know. It could be, but I discovered that something I never knew, that my music was sensual music. It was sexual. I never intended to do sensual music, but my only intention was to write the music I feel, that I think it's very religious, it's very melancholic, it's sad, it could be very sophisticated, it could be very aggressive, it's very revolutionary. I mean, It's contemporary popular music, and it has a little everything. The only thing that my music doesn't have is the word happy. There's no happiness.
That's an interesting point. Why isn't there?
Because I think the happiness, we, the musicians, have happiness when we play it. We love to play that way. We love to be melancholic. We love to be religious. And that's the way we get happy, because that's the lesson I learned, that the only thing that's important on a stage is to see a musician happy. If you're not happy, that means you don't like what you're playing.
Well, I want to play an excerpt from the album that introduced you to many Americans a couple of years ago. The album is called Zero Hour, and it's on the American Clave record. And this is another composition of yours. This is called Concerto for Quintet. And let's listen. Music from Astor Piazzolla's album Zero Hour, which was released a couple of years ago on the American Clave record. And Astor Piazzolla is an Argentinian composer, the founder of the New Tango. That's a wonderful piece. Are you still hated by older people in Argentina for what you've done for the tango? Has that all died down, or are you still considered by many to be the assassin of the tango?
Well, we signed a peace project 10 days ago. It was my idea. I don't want to get into it. Maybe it's because I'm feeling old, that I am no longer a warrior.
I don't really understand what kind of... I've never heard of a musical peace treaty before that people literally signed.
Well, this is a way of saying it wasn't... We didn't sign...
It's not a document that you got together and signed.
I mean... It's a pact.
It's a truce.
There was a war between them and me during 35 years. And I just said, let's... No more... Shooting the words, criticizing them and them criticizing me. Let's forget that, please. And I don't want the tango people to be separated. So I just called them, and they, in 1.5 hour, I had 200 musicians and singers and dancers and orchestra leaders waiting for me to give us to give a big hug and say, Astor Piazzolla, thank you for all you did. And thank you for this idea to be all together and helping the music of tango.
Well, let's face it, in a way, I mean, the new tango departs from the traditional tango, but your work is at the forefront of a tango revival, so you're really spreading tango around the world.
Yes, but there's another tango that is spreading around the world. It's the dance of tango that I adore, really, but it's not my job to play that music.
Oh, no, let's stop here a second. Now, obviously, you really love the tango that you've departed from, right?
Yeah, I love to see it. I feel it, but I don't...
You don't want to play it.
I don't play because it's old-fashioned. I mean, I play what's 88 and not what's 48.
Let me ask you, are there any American real schlocky interpretations of tangos that you get a real kick out of now?
Well, I think that not only Americans, I think the fault is of the Europeans, the Germans and the French and the Italians, who had an idea, of what really tango was. And that spread that came to our United States, and when Louis Armstrong used to play I Get Ideas, and when other musicians played Hernando's Hideaway, that was really a kick in the liver when I heard Hernando's Hideaway. That was terrible. And the Argentines were furious because that was making fun of what really was our tango was. I mean, our tango is something completely different. I insist, when somebody really knows how to dance, and when they dance the tango profoundly as they feel it, you can see that it's like making love. I mean, it's as if nobody was looking at them. And it's something you'd really love. That's why they dance that way.
So when you hear Hernando's Hideaway now, do you laugh or do you get angry?
I get sick.
You get sick still.
I see. I get sick yet.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, it's been very nice. Thank you.
Ester Piazzolla is an Argentinian composer and bandoneon player. He's the founder of the New Tango. His most recent recording is Concerto for Bandoneon on Nonesuch Records. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with writer Wilfried Sheed. He's written many essays and reviews, biographies of Muhammad Ali and Claire Booth Luce, and several novels, including last year's satire of the New York literary scene, The Boys of Winter. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional funding comes from World of Travel Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from NPR member stations and from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Jazz singer Helen Merrill has recorded more than 35 albums in her career. Two of those albums are recorded in collaboration with the late Gil Evans. Coming up, Helen Merrill talks about working with Evans and about her career singing in the States, Europe, and Japan. Also, now that the writer's strike has ended, television critic David Bianculli has a preview of the first and only entry of the new season so far. It's an NBC comedy series called Baby Boom, starring Kate Jackson, and it's based on the movie of the same name, which starred Diane Keaton. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of an album of Ken Werner performing the piano music of Bix Beiderbecke, Duke Ellington, George Gershwin, and James P. Johnson. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. The final sprint of the 1988 presidential race began on this Labor Day as both George Bush and Michael Dukakis try to shake the voter indifference that has the candidates running neck and neck. In California, Bush attacked Dukakis' opposition to the death penalty and higher defense spending. Dukakis told working-class families in Philadelphia that Bush represents the party of the rich and criticized the growing gap between the rich and poor. In Bangladesh, government officials say vast amounts of food have been destroyed in the worst floods in the country's history. Diplomats and other officials involved in an international relief effort met with government ministers in the capital of Dhaka today. The BBC's Mark Tully has details.
At the meeting, the Bangladesh planning minister said he feared that up to 3 million tons of grain in storage had been destroyed by flood waters. In one town, Faridpur, all four government grain stores have been flooded. The president, General Ershad, has said that he estimates that the damage to the current crop will be about 3 million tons. If these two forecasts prove correct, Bangladesh will have lost the equivalent of a third of its annual grain production. Apart from food aid, donors have been told that the country urgently needs more medicines, especially medicines to prevent dehydration caused by diarrhea. The official figure for those suffering from diarrhea and other waterborne diseases is roughly 100,000. There's an acute shortage of water purifying pills. The government is asking for Bailey bridges to enable roads to be reopened and material for constructing temporary shelters.
Mark Tully reporting from Bangladesh. Firefighters in Yellowstone National Park are closely watching a backfire burning along the park's northeast entrance. It's hoped the 3-mile-long backfire line will turn back a more than 61,000-acre blaze, which is threatening two Montana towns. Some residents of Silvergate and Cook City were evacuated last night as a precaution. Elsewhere, a rash of fires in Southern California has blackened more than 18,000 acres of brush and timber and damaged at least 26 buildings. Accused Soviet spy Shabti Kalmanovich went on trial in Israel today, charged with high treason and passing secrets to Soviet intelligence agents. If convicted, he could be sentenced to life in prison. Jim Letterman reports from Jerusalem.
Kalmanovich arrived in Israel as an immigrant from Russia in the 1970s. He quickly became involved in local politics and Soviet Jewish immigrant organizations. Within a few years, however, he appeared to have abandoned these interests for a rapidly growing business empire that stretched from the United States to Africa to Eastern Europe. Last December, the high-living Kalmanovich was arrested. The specific charges against him have never been revealed publicly, but his extensive travels and contacts would have allowed him to gather information on Israel and African countries with ease. His trial is being held behind closed doors, but the court did allow his lawyer to tell reporters today that most of the session was taken up with Kalmanovich's assertion that the admission of guilt, which he signed during his interrogation, was not made of his free will, and therefore should be invalidated. His lawyer, while refusing to indicate what the line of defense will be, predicted a short trial. In Jerusalem, I'm Jim Letterman.
A reconditioned Titan II rocket lifted off from Vandenberg Air Force Base today, carrying what experts believe is a Navy spy satellite. It was apparently the second launch of a U.S. spy satellite in less than a week. Last Friday, a satellite said to be designed to intercept Soviet communications was launched from Cape Canaveral, but the spacecraft reportedly failed to achieve its desired stationary orbit, rendering the satellite useless. Titan IIs were built in the 1960s as intercontinental ballistic missiles, but maintenance and safety problems led to removal of the missiles from their silos in Arkansas, Kansas, and Arizona. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Our jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of a reissue of an album by pianist Ken Werner. Werner is a classically trained jazz musician. He has turned up as a sideman on numerous LPs, from one of Charles Mingus's last dates to a recent quartet release by tenor saxophonist Joe Lovano. But before Werner made a reputation for himself in jazz, he recorded an album that Kevin says jazz listeners should know about.
Duke Ellington's highest compliment was to describe a performer's music as beyond category. But the fact remains that music that doesn't fall neatly into one category or another often fails to find an audience. Back in 1978, the versatile jazz pianist Ken Werner put out an album on Finadar, a somewhat obscure classical music-oriented subsidiary of Atlantic Records. The album was called The Piano Music of Bix Beiderbecke, Duke Ellington, George Gershwin, and James P. Johnson. Despite some favorable reviews, it had a predictable fate. Jazz record buyers rarely came across it. Classical buyers, or non-buyers, dismissed it as a jazz record, although none of the music was improvised. Ken Werner's 1978 recital has now been reissued on compact disc as part of an Atlantic Jazz series. It's an exquisite collection of 14 rags and parlor pieces written between 1916 and 1943, including the sentimental Poem of Love by stride piano king James P. Johnson, an early Gershwin rag, impressionistic studies by trumpeter Bix Beiderbecke, and a piano reduction of Ellington's orchestral work, New World A-Comin'. It's not a flawless set. The Ellington transcription is a bit florid and long, but Werner combines a classical pianist's refined touch and reverence for the score with a jazz musician's confident swing. He's also selected some splendid compositions. To my ears, the Gershwin piano pieces from the 20s and 30s show a deeper appreciation of jazz and blues than do his better-known works for orchestra. Here's Werner playing George Gershwin's first piano prelude from 1926. Ken Werner's program challenges our assumptions about the crude nature of early jazz. He reminds us that James P. Johnson was a sophisticated composer as well as a rent-party piano gladiator. And it's hard to think of 20s jazz as harmonically primitive while listening to Bix Beiderbecke's delicate piano pieces. Yet for all their impressionistic grace, they still betray jazzy theme and variation structure and forward momentum, no matter how quietly expressed. Here's an excerpt from Bix Beiderbecke's Flashes. We rightly tend to think of jazz as an improviser's music, and yet its birth and growth have been tied to mechanical forms of reproduction, From the turn of the century ragtime scores that popularized syncopated music, to the player piano rolls and phonograph records that spread jazz to the hinterlands. Besides, even if Ken Werner plays from sheet music on this album, the Beiderbecke pieces were transcribed by arranger Bill Challis, who sat at the composer's side as he sketched out his tunes at the keyboard. Recording some of the same Beiderbecke tunes at around the same time, guitarist Ry Cooter observed that there has always been a lot going on at the periphery of popular jazz trends. Ken Werner's solo album eloquently reminds us that neither early jazz nor its history is as simple as we may choose to remember it.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat, Cadence, and Jazz Times. He reviewed Ken Werner plays the piano music of Beiderbecke, Ellington, Gershwin, and Johnson on the Finidar Atlantic label. You're listening to Fresh Air. More than 30 years ago, before jazz arranger Gil Evans became known for his collaborations with Miles Davis on now classic albums like Miles Ahead, Porgy and Bess, and Sketches of Spain, he did arrangements for an album by singer Helen Merrill. Shortly before Evans' death in March, he and Helen Merrill went back to the studio to re-record the material from their earlier record. Although Merrill has recorded more than 35 albums in her career, she's better known in Europe and Japan, where she lived for many years. Now she lives in New York City. I asked Helen Merrill how she and Gil Evans made the decision to re-record the old material.
He wanted to make a new record with me, and he was very enthusiastic and so on. But unfortunately, Gil's health was declining somewhat. He was having problem with his eyes, and it was difficult for him to write. So we then thought of doing the old music over again, which is never really old. It's a form of classical music as far as I'm concerned.
I'd like to try something. Can we compare a song from the two records and see how they sound in the older version and the new version?
Sure.
Great. Why don't we start with the new record? And this is your new recording with arrangements by Gil Evans of I'm a Fool to Want You.
I'm a fool to want you. I'm a fool to want you. To want a love that can't be true. A love that's there for others too. I'm a fool.
Listening back to that, what do you think you did differently than in the first version?
Well, in the first place, it's a half tone lower.
Okay.
And in the second, I do a song differently every time I sing it. It's a different feeling. I've been a fool many times over since then, so I'd have a different view of being a fool, and I suspect it's reflected in my version.
You know, I just have to tell you, before we hear the first version of it, that I love the way you space in your phrasing, I'm a fool to want you. It's really beautiful.
Yeah, well, thank you. Yeah, I think of lyrics as a way of portraying what we are feeling inside, and the words just sort of punctuate those feelings.
Okay, let's go back a little over 30 years and listen to your first recording of that with Gil Evans' arrangements. And this is Helen Merrill singing I'm a Fool to Want You.
I'm a fool. Want you. I'm a fool to want you. To want a love that can't be true. A love that's there for others too. I'm a fool.
do you think about hearing that back now?
I think I did pretty well 30 years ago with the phrasing, and the music was certainly different. The key makes it sound quite different. The new record is a lot darker.
Yes, it is. That's right.
Yes, and Gil's conducting of the orchestra was entirely different. I think he was feeling differently, too, about music when we did the second record.
Would you explain what you mean by that?
Well, he was kind of feeling, I think, a little sadder than he did when we did the record 30 years ago. We had many conversations. He was very insulted by old age, and he was very frustrated by the inability of his body to respond to his brain. You know, the problems with his eyes, and he just was insulted by old age, and his head was certainly not there. And so I think that was reflected in the way he performed the music.
The one new song that you recorded for the new record.
Ah, I like that one.
It's called Summertime.
Yeah.
I mean, it's called Summertime. Well, we all know Summertime. Why did you choose Summertime as the one extra song?
Because I like it.
Uh-huh. It's a very striking interpretation.
Thank you. That's a wonderful jazz vehicle. And I knew that it would be something that I would enjoy doing with Gil. As simple as that.
I think it's a hard song to make fresh, since so many people have sung it already.
That's the beauty of jazz, though. You know, I think you can make everything fresh. I mean, there are so many ways to look at the emotions of those lyrics. I have sung it very angrily. I've sung it hopelessly and helplessly. I've sung it through the mind of the Universal Mother. You know, it's not at all a boring emotion. It's a very, very deep one that's going to exist forever. So it can't be boring. And as far as the music is concerned, that certainly is not. So, no, I don't think that you can do that song enough too many times.
Summertime. It's easy. Fish are jumping, the cotton is high. Your daddy's rich, your mother's...
Your mother was a Seventh-day Adventist, right?
That's right.
When you started singing in clubs, did she oppose that?
My mother was not around to see that, but I can assure you she would have more than opposed it, yes.
She would have tried to prevent it.
Oh, no doubt about that, yeah.
So did you feel at all guilty about that?
I compensated.
How so?
Well, I was very shy, and I remained to myself pretty much, and I didn't put on too much perfume or lipstick on stage. Didn't go to too many dances until...
Didn't wear low-cut gowns?
No, definitely not. In fact, I used to forget to change my shoes sometime to go on stage, and one time Dinah Washington caught me. She said, Helen, come back here. I have to talk to you. And you can't go on stage with shoes like that.
What were you wearing?
My Oxfords with an evening gown on. So, no, I wasn't too into what one was supposed to be into. You know, trying to be a star, but it was a lot to do with being Seventh-day Adventist. Yeah, really did.
You spent most of the 60s and 70s abroad, first living in Italy and then living in Japan. Why did you leave the United States?
Well, at that time, the only work available to me, and again, perhaps this is where the religion sort of came into it, but the only work available was a rotten, lousy, dirty jazz clubs and places I wouldn't go to visit if I... You know, I just wouldn't even step inside them. And it was degrading to work in places like that. And furthermore, there was no money. Mostly people would drink and make a lot of noise. And it was just not dignified. A lot of us left the country at that time. And I found, to my surprise, that I did a lot of television shows. I did things that I certainly didn't do at home.
When you came back to the United States sometime in the 70s, was it hard for you to re-enter the jazz scene which you were so anxious to leave before?
It wasn't the jazz scene that I was leaving. And I wouldn't want to re-enter that scene that I left. I still don't want that scene. That hasn't changed. It is, I mean, re-enter the world of music, the business of music, like recording and so on. Yes, it was difficult.
I think your new record is going to get you a lot more attention in the United States now.
That'd be very nice. You mean, oh, I hope so. I hope you're right. Then I can do those nice college dates and things in this country. That'd be very nice. I'd like it. Seriously.
Well, I wish you the best, and I thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, then.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Singer Helen Merrill. Her new album with the late Gil Evans is called Collaboration. It's on Polygram Records, which has also reissued a box set of the album she recorded for Mercury Records in the 1950s. The reissue is titled The Complete Helen Merrill.
As I walk down the street, seems everyone I meet gives me a friendly hello. I guess I'm just a lucky so-and-so. The birds in every tree all seem so neighborly.
This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on this Labor Day edition of All Things Considered and check in with co-host Renee Montaigne. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What's your lead story?
Well, our lead story tonight is the flooding in Bangladesh. There is an estimated 25 million people who have been driven from their homes by floods in Bangladesh. Now, every year the monsoons cause flooding there, but no one has ever seen anything like this.
Are you also putting aside some time for holiday stories?
Yes, we are. We have a report, one of our holiday stories, a report on taste testers, people whose job it is to make sure that food products are up to snuff. And we also take a trip to Yosemite. And Terry, guess what we find there?
Yogi Bear.
You know, I don't know. We might have found Yogi Bear, but we also found lots and lots of people.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. If you're frustrated with primetime reruns, this Saturday night you've got a chance to try something new. Television critic David Bianculli has a review of Baby Boom.
The commercial networks are going to try very hard to fool everybody this month and next month and pretend that it's business as usual, the start of another new fall season. The writer's strike slowed things down so much, though, that the only way September can be called the start of the fall season is in the sense that the networks are about to fall flat on their faces. Even though CBS, NBC, and ABC are already trotting out their fall promotional campaigns, most of their new series won't be showing up until November or December. A year ago, 21 new series premiered during the month of September. This month, there's only one, and after this week's special sneak preview, it crawls away and hibernates until November. This one brief taste of the 1988 fall TV season is the pilot episode of Baby Boom, an NBC comedy based on the movie starring Diane Keaton. The TV version has the same set of twins playing the baby, but its star and its plot are very different. NBC's Baby Boom stars Kate Jackson as businesswoman J.C. Wyatt. And this time, when she inherits a toddler from a distant cousin, she doesn't pack up and leave the city to be a full-time mom. She holds her ground, juggling her professional responsibilities with her new personal ones.
Charlotte. What? Yes, Fritz been looking for me?
No. Helga called.
Yeah, they got home.
Good. Look, I need you to call these numbers and find out which classes are given at lunch, before work, after work, and on weekends, and sign me up for whatever's available.
Finger painting, computer, mime, gymnastics, violin?
Yeah, they're for Elizabeth.
She's not too young for
Well,
this?
No, I know it sounds a little much, but, you know, I don't want the other kids running computer while she's still playing Mr. Potato Head.
TV's version of Baby Boom takes place 5 months after the delivery, so to speak, of baby Elizabeth. As a spin-off, it has a few direct links to the movie that inspired it. Sam Wanamaker reprises his role as JC's boss, and the same people who wrote and produced the movie are producing the series. The best thing you can say about this new Baby Boom, though, is that it doesn't have a laugh track. I don't have any problems with Kate Jackson in the starring role. She has a good touch for light comedy and plays the role a lot less frazzled than Diane Keaton did in the movie. But the message here is just as muddled as the one in the film version. In the movie, Keaton gave it all up but got it all back, launching a successful baby food business and finding the love of her life in the process. In the TV show, Jackson doesn't give anything up. She copes, and copes very well. The pilot episode, at least, plays like a spin-off of 30-something, a description that'll make some people curious and other people nauseous. Personally, I'm just happy that NBC is offering this sneak peek of things to come. Now that we know what we're missing, maybe we won't miss it so much.
This weekend, we'll go to Bloomingdale's, and you can pick out any blanket you want, any color.
Yeah.
You can pick out two blankies.
Mm-hmm.
You want your blankie?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it'll turn up.
Yeah?
Yeah. We know it will, don't we?
That's Kate Jackson in her charge in Baby Boom. David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post.
Twinkle, Mommy.
Twinkle, twinkle, little star. How I wonder what you are. Up above the world so high, like a diamond in the sky. I can't believe what I just found. I can't believe it. I'm going to faint.
Yay!
It's the blankie. Can you believe that? Blankie, where have you been? Don't you ever do that again, and I mean it.
Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Actress Jane Alexander is well known for her roles in Eleanor and Franklin, Kramer vs. Kramer, All the President's Men, and Testament. On the next Fresh Air, she tells us why she's been spending much of her time behind the scenes in the role of producer. Also, rock historian Ed Ward reviews the career of Alex Chilton. He got his start singing lead with the Box Tops, whose hits included The Letter and Cry Like a Baby. And John Leonard reviews film director Ingmar Bergman's new autobiography, The Magic Lantern. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from NPR member stations and from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Lisa Bruton, Ed Doherty, and Becky Thorne. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. And thanks to our engineer Ojivo Blitus, who temporarily leaves us for a special project. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.